Flashman and the Angel of the Lord by George MacDonald Fraser, continued. Cassette 10, Side 1.
I'd seen that look before in French hotels, and while it was unexpected here, it was by no means unwelcome. I wasn't as exhausted as all that. Of course, I might be misreading his expression and find myself closeted with some boring old buffer who couldn't sleep. A mess if he had told me to stay close. But what the blazes, it was only next door, and the darkie was positively leering. "That's most civil of the gentleman," says I, and he tittered behind his hand in a way that settled my doubts and brought me off the cot, smoothing my hair and glancing in the glass. He effaced himself, and I slipped out and knuckled the timber adjoining. No reply, so I turned the handle and found myself in an empty but well-lit cabin. It was one with an alcove bunk, with the curtains drawn. Eureka, thinks I, twitching the curtains aside. And,
"Well, hello yourself, handsome," says Mrs. Popplewell.
I stood rooted in astonishment, partly from the shock of seeing her, of all people, when I'd expected some railroad rattler, partly because she was reclining languidly on one elbow like that continental tart in the painting. You know the one, bare buff except for a ribbon round her neck, and a nigger maid in the background. Mrs. Popplewell wasn't wearing even a ribbon. She lay there, all black and glossy in the lamplight, smiling a welcome and extending a plump hand. And if I hadn't been so dumbfounded, I dare say I'd have pressed it to my lips on the spot, if you know what I mean.
"Seen you coming to the train,"
says she in answer to my incoherent inquiry.
"Couldn't hardly believe my eyes. Why, I made sure you was gone in that awful fighting last night and this morning. Never see such doings, shootings and killings."
She seized my nerveless hand and dragged me into a sitting position beside her.
"Well, don't just gape like a fish out of water. Tell me what happened and where you been and how you come to be here. Unless..."
She grinned hugely and transferred her hand from my wrist to my breeches.
"Unless you can think of something better to do first. Oh, ma, I should think you can."
She was right, you know. The babble of questions that rose to my lips became a muted howl as she fondled with one hand and hauled me down with the other. I seized hold, marvelling at my luck, and fairly wallowed, partaking of refreshment, as the porter had advised. And I must say, de party in de next cabin was sociably inclined to the point of delirium. It was a wonder that the train didn't jump the tracks, and only when she'd subsided, moaning, and I got my breath back, did we resume the conversation, with mutual expressions of bewilderment, before all was explained. Explained on my side, that is, for she brushed aside my demands to know how she'd fared with Sin and the ruffian interrogating her. I'd have thought that my sudden descent from the skylight and my precipitate departure thereafter would have compromised her altogether. But apparently not. She'd been able to satisfy Sin of her innocence, she said, and $10 apiece from her purse had been enough for the others.
"They ain't used to black ladies with money. Tuck the starch right out of them,"
she chuckled.
"But that don't matter. I's here, ain't I? But how'd you get out of that scrape? Why, honey, I never thought to see you live again. Now you just tell Hannah, 'cause she's dying to hear. Say, but let me kiss you first, you big loving machine. But you know, you just play gentle while you tell me. But don't talk too long, will you? 'Cause we got a deal of pleasuring to do before we get to Baltimore."
So I spun her, at greater length, the yarn I'd told her on first acquaintance, that I was in the employ of the U.S. government, and had enlisted in J.B.'s band as a spy, even to the length of taking part in their raid. All of which was true enough, as was my explanation of why I'd taken refuge with her until such time as it was safe for me to reveal myself to someone in authority. And you saw what it was like, all the confusion and shooting, with those drunk madmen who'd have killed me on sight. It was only after I got away from your room, and I say I'm awfully sorry I had to mishandle you so roughly.
"You mishandle me any old way you like, darling,"
she purred, toying lazily in a most distracting fashion.
"Go on, honey, tell me more, but keep right on mishandling."
Well,
I managed to get away, and by great good luck, the Marines had arrived, and I was able to make myself known to Colonel Lee. That the fine soldier with the mustache I saw this afternoon come to the hotel with Governor Wise and the other people? Say, there was one real fine man there, big and handsome, kind of like you, but not near as lovesome. Made me all shivery, though, just to look at him. My, but I just love men with black beards and whiskers. Like you best with just your whiskers, though. Gives me something to bite at.
And she nibbled my chin.
Yes, well, when I'd spoken to Lee, of course, everything was all right. You know what happened after that. The Marines caught Brown and the others, and that was the end of it. And now I'm on my way to Baltimore, as you see, to report to my superiors.
You sure are one lucky man,
says she, stroking my whiskers.
And I'm one lucky gal. Why, when I saw you coming to the train with that tall gentleman. Say, he's a right pretty fella, too. He a friend of yours?
What? Who? Oh, that fellow. No, don't know who he is. One of the governor's people, I think.
Why, I don't know. I felt the less I said about Messivy, the better.
The handsome man you saw with Colonel Lee, by the way, was probably Lieutenant Stewart. Fancied him, did you? You know what, Hannah? I have a notion you fancy all men, don't you?
You bet, darling,
says she, pushing her tongue into my mouth.
That's my weakness, but I just fancy him one at a time. Now, hold on there. You must be dry after all that talking.
She slipped from my grasp and got out to fill two glasses at the buffet. I put mine down at a gulp, while she sipped hers standing. Then she put down her glass and, vibrating her gleaming bulk in the lamplight, looking down at me and hefting her huge poonce in her hands, smiling wickedly at my reaction.
I reckon you're about ready now,
says she. And once again she was right, absolutely.
Well now,
says she afterwards,
that was what I calls pleasure.
She shivered, sitting astride and stretched luxuriously, her arms above her head. Then she sighed regretfully, and removed her massive weight from my creaking thighs, climbing out and donning her peignoir.
I'm real sorry it is over. Shouldn't have done it, not once, let alone twice. But I gotta tell you, darling, you are the screwiest man I ever did see. That's my excuse.
She sighed again.
Anyway, that was pleasure. And now, business.
She sat down carefully on the chair across the cabin and asked mildly,
what happened to Joe Simmons?
I gave a start that almost brought the cot loose from its moorings, but I couldn't speak for shock, and she went on,
you know Joe, now. He was with you when you came to the hotel first time I saw you, Mr. LaForce's man who brought you up to New York, and then to Concord and so on after.
She fluttered her fingers, and even in my stunned bewilderment I realized that the broad Dixie Negro voice had modulated into soft southern tones.
We know he was in that engine house, but he never came out with the others. What happened to him?
We? It was all I could say.
Sure. The Ku Klux?
The plump, pug face beamed in a smile.
Didn't Atropos tell you we'd be watching you and Joe all the way? Sure he did. Oh, we lost you in New York for a spell when the police took those three fellas who were shadowing you and Miss Mandeville. Mr. LaForce was real grieved about her. Thought she was true to him. Never suspected she was operating for the government till you and she showed up in company with Messivy. You see, we have a man watching him permanent. Those three men of Hermes's in New York, they weren't the only ones we got up there.
I found I was shaking in every limb as I lay there stark on the cot. Instinctively, I jerked the sheets over myself, and her big lips twitched in a smile.
Don't do that, sweetheart. I just love looking at you. My, but you are the finest. Now then, tell me about Joe.
Why, I don't know what you mean. If he was in the engine house, well, he must have been killed or captured.
If he was in there. You know he was. You were in there your own self. We saw you come out this morning with Messivy.
You saw...
Not me, one of my boys. I have two of them. They're at the ferry right now, watching the engine house, waiting to see what happened to Joe.
She was regarding me almost amiably, shaking her head.
But you're all confused, so I better tell you. I'm Medusa. You know, Mr. LaForce likes to give us those old names. I've been in these parts all summer, having you watched at the farm and so forth. Oh, Joe didn't know about that. Didn't know about me, even, being a lot lower down in the cook class than I am. All he had to do was watch you. See, you did as Mr. LaForce desired. You know, the raid.
She smiled approvingly.
You did that right well, too, didn't you? Well, leastways, it happened, which was what we wanted. Mr. LaForce will be right pleased with you. Maybe give you the $10,000 you asked for, if you feel like collecting. Do you?
She was watching me closely now as I sat palpitating, too shaken to think, let alone speak. I felt as though I'd been struck by a thunderbolt. It was incredible. Too much to take in.
We didn't mind you working for the government, or pretending to work for them, whichever it was. As things were, you didn't have a choice, did you? What did they want you to do, anyway? Stop Brown making the raid, or help him to make it? Mr. LaForce couldn't make up his mind about that. My belief is... Oh, well, don't matter what I believe. The raid went in, that's what matters.
She rose from the chair, took my glass, and refilled it.
You look like you need this, darling. Go on, drink it down. And don't look like you saw a ghost. All's well. Except for Joe. We have to know what happened to him in that engine house. He was quite a pet of Mr. LaForce's, you know. He'll be real grieved if anything bad's happened to Joe.
She swayed ponderously back to her seat.
So, there's two questions to answer. What happened to Joe? And why didn't he cut loose and run at the hotel when you did? When I watched the two of you from my window come into the hotel yesterday morning, I thought, clever fellas, they've done their work, and now the raid's happened, they're getting away from Brown. You did. And you know what?
She chuckled, the great body shaking with mirth.
When you came in my door, I thought, how does he know to run to me? He can't know who I am, that I'm Medusa. He can't know I'm Kuklos. And then pretty soon I saw that you did, and it was just chance brought you to me. And darling,
she broke into laughter,
I never missed such a chance. Oh, that was some morning sport we had together. I was so melted I thought to tell you who I was. But then I'd seen Joe go back to Brown. I couldn't understand that. I suspicioned something was wrong somewhere, so I kept quiet. Showed you the way out to the loft, though, didn't I, when it looked like...
It don't usually take me long to act when I'm cornered, but I'd been so shaken that only in the last minute had I summoned my wits sufficiently to move. One ghastly fact had imprinted itself on my mind. She had men watching the engine house. They'd have seen the Marines bring out Joe's body under cover of darkness and bury it by the river. They'd dig it up for certain and find two bullets in his back. And who'd put them there, then? From all that I'd seen of the Kuklos, especially in the last 10 minutes, they were experts. They'd know or soon find out that the attackers hadn't fired a single shot. They'd report to Atropos that his pet nigger had been shot and buried clandestine by the government, for whom I might or might not have been acting. By God, he'd want to get to the bottom of it, and he'd not ask as gently as this damn Medusa Popplewell. All this in a flash through my mind to one lightning conclusion, instant flight. And she was only one woman. I came off the bed in a bound and stopped dead before the derringer in her great black hand.
Oh, darling,
says she,
that was foolish. What do you got to be fractious for, hmm?
She shook her head, no longer smiling.
Now then, I've asked and I'm waiting. Why did Joe go back to Brown? And what happened to him afterwards?
Well, I could answer the first question at least.
He went back to Brown because he was betraying you. It's the truth. He went over to Brown's side. I don't know why, but he... Well, Brown convinced him at the farm that the raid would lead to a slave rebellion, and that it would succeed and they'd all win their freedom. Joe believed him, I tell you. He changed sides. He told me so. I swear to God, it's true.
She didn't move a muscle. The plump, black features were without expression. The derringer stayed trained on my midriff.
And what happened in the engine house?
Well, I don't know. I never saw him after the attack. I don't know. I tell you, maybe he was killed or captured.
You didn't like him, did you? Fact is, you couldn't bite him. So Mr. LaForce figured. He thought it was real amusing. Figured you and Joe were rivals for the favors of Miss Mandeville. Were you?
When I didn't reply, she shrugged.
It don't matter. She ain't around anymore. Mr. LaForce can't abide traitors.
Well, Joe was a traitor. I swear he was.
I don't disbelieve you, darling. I wouldn't trust a nigger an inch myself.
She sat there black and placid as she said it.
Did you kill Joe?
No, for God's sake, why should I?
Maybe because you hated him. Maybe for the U.S. government. Maybe even because you're telling true when you say Joe went over to Brown and you killed him out of loyalty to Mr. LaForce and that $5,000 he promised you. Honey, I don't mind.
She leaned forward, smiling almost wistfully. But the derringer was steady as a rock.
What's one black buck, more or less? If you killed him, fine. It don't matter to Hannah.
I didn't, I swear to God,
dearest. You don't need to. Not to me. It's what you swear to Mr. LaForce that signifies. And whether he believes you. And I truly do doubt whether he'll believe Joe betrayed him. You know, Joe and he were boys together, playmates. Why, he loved that Joe like a brother. About the only thing he ever loved, I guess. And if Joe's dead, and my boys will find it out, if he is, I don't know what Mr. LaForce will do.
She shook her head sadly.
But if he suspicions that you killed him, and I do, so I guess he might. Well, I just hope you can prove you didn't.
I sat like a rabbit before a snake while she regarded me with pity and concern. Then she smiled again and reached out to stroke my cheek with her free hand.
Oh, darling, don't look so down. I tell you it don't matter to me. You can kill every nigger in creation if you've a mind to, far as I'm concerned. You know why?
Her eyes narrowed and her voice was trembling.
'Cause you pleasured me like I never been pleasured before. I didn't know there was pleasuring like that. And believe me, boy, I made a study. I come over faint just thinking about you.
She shivered and grimaced.
And now, I gotta go back to Popplewell. Oh, sure, the E is a Popplewell, randy little runt. All I told you about him and my other husbands is true. Except I married him 2 years ago, not 2 days. And 'twasn't him, but one of my white boys left me at the wager house.
She gave one of her gross chuckles.
Think they'd take a nigger woman there, be her husband never so rich? No, but they'd take the devil herself if the cook lost his pan the bell.
She stood up, and to my amazement slipped the derringer into the bosom of her robe. Then she stooped over me, took my face in her hands, looking soulful, and kissed me with sudden passion, her tongue and lips working feverishly at my mouth and cheeks and eyes, and back to my mouth again, before she broke moistly away, breathing hard.
Oh, I got such a kindness for you, Mr. Beecham Cobber, or Miss Tom Arnold, or whatever your name is. I don't know, and I don't care. And I got such a misery when I thinks what Mr. LaForce'll do.
She shuddered enormously with a little whimpering sigh, and I thought, now's your time, lad, and thrust me whiskers between her boobies, going brrr. She let out an ecstatic wail, the derringer clattered to the floor, and I sank, clutching fingers into her buttocks and munched away for dear life, for I could see only one way out of this fearful dilemma, to play on her feminine frailty in the only way I know how. But even as I grappled, roaring, lustful endearments, she heaved away from me, eyes rolling, and thrust out a mighty hand to hold me at arm's length.
Oh, darling! Oh, God of mercy!
And in her agitation it came out in broad Dixie.
Oh, honey, don't think I ain't craving you, 'cause I is something cruel. But we ain't got the time, damn it!
She stamped, rattling the cabin, and her eyes were wild.
There's only one stop between here and Baltimore, and it's coming up real soon. Oh, Lordy, there's the whistle. Don't stand there,
she panted, seizing my wrist.
You got to get off, because my boys at the ferry will telegraph ahead when they find out whatever's happened to Joe, and the cook class will be awaiting in Baltimore, and I can't let them take you. I just can't, because, oh, my dearie, if anything was to happen to you, I believe I'd die.
She surged to the door and wrenched it open, and damned if she wasn't snivelling great tears over her shiny black cheeks.
So get out of here now, will you? Oh, give me one last kiss, too. Now, get your ass off of this train and take care. You hear?
Here the 10th packet of the Flashman Papers ends. At what one must assume is the conclusion of the author's memoir of John Brown and the Harper's Ferry episode. What followed will no doubt appear in a later installment of Sir Harry's recollections. All that can be said with certainty is that he did not catch the Baltimore packet to Liverpool. Since we know from evidence in the 8th packet of the papers, already published, that 6 months after his emotional parting from Mrs. Popplewell, he was in Hong Kong, without having visited England in the meantime. Appendix 1. Flashman and John Brown. Flashman's was not an affectionate nature, that he loved, or at least was enthralled by, his wife Elspeth is evident from his memoirs, and now and then his regard for other ladies goes some way beyond the merely physical. Usually one suspects when he's writing in a mood of brandy-assisted nostalgia. But outside his family, he plainly doted on his great-grandchildren, and felt for his natural son, Frank Standing Bear, a paternal affection which lasted for several days. He seldom finds much to like in people. He betrays an occasional fellow feeling at a safe distance. For such rascals as Rudy von Starnberg, and as a half-amiable tolerance of acquaintances whom he has no cause to detest, like his old chief, Colin Campbell, and his Afghan blood brother, Ilderim Khan. But that, as a rule, is his limit. Yet he seems to have had a kind of protective affection for John Brown, underneath the sneers and curses, there is a hint of indulgence, an inclination to defend the old nuisance, and even to give him a Tuscan cheer, which is not characteristic of Flashman. We may be sure it springs from no kindly or charitable impulse, or the least sympathy with Brown's aims. He found the man and his mission ridiculous, and writes of them with contempt. At the same time, he remembers Brown as a bloody hard man to dislike, which is a rare tribute. Of course, it may have been a gratifying novelty to Flashman to come across a strong and fearsome autocrat who treated him with some deference and respect. A strong man, moreover, whom he could manipulate, and in whom he detected an appealing streak of humbug. And however lofty his disdain of Brown, there is no doubt that he took a perverse pride in their association. I was one of John Brown's pet lambs, after all. This is pure Flashman. Throughout his memoirs, he revels in reflected glory, the more so when it is ingloriously undeserved. And when it comes to dining out, Harper's Ferry plainly ranks with Balaclava and Little Bighorn and Cornpaw. One detects a condescending gratitude to Brown and his ragged commandos for adding another leaf to the Flashman laurels, and a complacent satisfaction that he helped them along the road to immortality. Whether he liked Brown or not, he has done him justice. The figure who stalks his narrative is the man of the biographies and contemporary accounts, even to his quoted speech, thoughts, manner, appearance, and the small details of every day, from their first meeting at Concord to the last glimpse of the weary, serene old prisoner lying in the paymaster's office. Flashman's story tallies convincingly with recorded facts, and differs no more from the standard authorities than they do from each other. His record of Brown's travels in the North may be verified in Villard, as may his account of life at the Kennedy Farm, of which Mrs. Annie Brown Adams, Brown's daughter, who acted as lookout for the conspirators, has left a lively record. As invariably happens when there is a multitude of eyewitnesses, there are many discrepancies to be found in accounts of the actual raid on Harper's Ferry. It would have been tedious and confusing to footnote them all, and most of them are trivial, It hardly matters whether John Brown visited the rifle works in person, or at which end of the Potomac Bridge the watchmen were posted, or whether Lee was on horseback, or what kind of hat Jeb Stuart wore, or the precise moment when Brown retreated to the engine house, or the exact place and time of certain incidents. There is no conflict on the main course of events, and here Flashman is in step with other historians. It was a weird affair, the handful of men invading in the dark, the hold-up and release of the train, the taking of the prisoners, the first haphazard shootings, the bewildered township waking to find itself menaced by terrorists, gunfight and murder alternating with parleys and demands for breakfast, the militia storming in and taking to drink, the brutal lynchings, and the local doctor tending the invaders' wounded, the siege of the engine house, the final call to surrender, the last bloody melee with the Marines, and most bizarre of all, the wounded Brown holding court while his captors bombard him with questions. The whole thing has elements of a modern hostage drama followed by a television press conference. It was a fiasco. The irony is that it need not have been. Brown, the most incompetent of planners and irresolute of leaders, gained an initial success of which a commando leader might be proud, and then did nothing. He could have stripped the arsenal and been in the hills without losing a man. That he could have organized a slave rebellion is highly improbable, but he would have struck a blow to shake the nation. It was shaken enough even by his failure. Why did he delay? Did he cling to the hope that the slaves would rally to him, as Cook had assured him that they would? It is possible, yet it seems more likely that Flashman's diagnosis is sound. Faced with crisis, Brown simply did not know what to do. His judgment failed him, as his courage never did. And with that fatal indecision, which was his besetting weakness, he threw away what little chance he had. But while Flashman may have read him aright at the ferry, and while his whole portrait of Brown is a fair one, he has probably come no closer than other biographers to explaining the old abolitionist's strange and complex character. It is not surprising. Brown was not understood in his own time, and much that has been written about him since has done more to embellish the legend than to clarify the nature of the man. He and his cause are emotional subjects, and the emotions often run to extremes. He has been described in terms that would become a saint, and vilified with an intemperance that is self-defeating. The impression persists in most people's minds of a good and simple soul, on fire with a dream, a fanatical crusader pursuing a splendid goal with imperfect means, a misguided Quixote whose head was wrong but whose heart was right. Great men and women have given him the accolade, and who that reads his story can dissent? Kindness, compassion, a burning love of liberty, a gift of inspiring devotion, and matchless courage he had. If, as has been charged, perhaps not unjustly, he was also devious, foolish, vain, selfish, unscrupulous, and irresolute in crisis, his admirers can say that these are human faults, and far outweighed by the simple nobility of the martyr who died, and died gladly to make men free. And then there is Pottawatomie. The question of his sanity cannot be answered now. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.